Shrink Wrap Radio number 345, Trauma Stewardship, with Laura Vandernoot Lipsky.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, and we'll be discussing her work with trauma survivors and those who work with them. Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, founder and director of the Trauma Stewardship Institute and author of Trauma Stewardship, An Everyday Guide to Caring for Self While Caring for Others, has worked directly with trauma survivors for 25 years. At age 18, she regularly spent nights volunteering in a homeless shelter. From there, she went on to work with survivors of child abuse, domestic violence, sexual assault, acute trauma, and natural disasters. Simultaneously, she has been active in community organizing and movements for school and environmental justice, and has taught on issues surrounding systematic oppression and liberation theory. Over a decade ago, Laura experienced what she calls a near psychotic break. It was the result of years of witnessing and being intimately involved in trauma without tending to herself in the necessary ways. After that, she began a journey of inquiry into the lasting effects on individuals and groups of exposure to the suffering, hardship, crisis, or trauma experienced by humans, other living beings, or the planet itself. She offered her first version of a workshop on trauma stewardship to a group of public health workers in 1999. Since then, she has trained a wide variety of people, including zookeepers and reconstruction workers in post-Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans, community organizers and healthcare providers in Japan, the U.S. Air Force pilots, Canadian firefighters, public school teachers, and private practice doctors. She has worked locally, nationally, and internationally. Laura is known as a pioneer in the field of trauma exposure. Recently, Laura turned her attention to the effects of trauma exposure on those doing frontline work in environmental and conservation movements throughout the world. She was among the first to talk publicly about the profound price that the witnessing of mass extinctions and the potentially irreversible ecological losses caused by global warming and other forms of human encroachment is exacting from the organizations and individuals who are attempting to save our planet. Now, here's the interview. Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's great to have you on the show. Somebody recommended strongly that I speak to you because I've been doing a number of interviews around issues related to trauma. Unfortunately, I can't remember now who it was. If they're listening, my apologies, but I did follow their advice. Probably it was one of my listeners, and somebody told me that you're doing important work in the field of trauma and that I should be covering your work. So that's how we happen to be together today. Let's start out by backing up a bit, and why don't you tell us the story of how you first became interested in trauma?
Well, there's two. I mean, I first became interested in trauma, I think, very much coming out of my own life and, you know, trying to reconcile situations that I had grown up in and with. So that's how I first became drawn to it. And I had an incredible professor, Dr. Applebaum, who's still at University of California, Santa Barbara, and continuing to do amazing work. And it was through his introduction that I first started volunteering with homelessness in Santa Barbara. And then that moved into child abuse and domestic violence and sexual assault and, you know, general trauma as a whole. So that was about 26 years ago. And then it was a number of years ago that I started focusing on this idea of cumulative toll or trauma exposure.
Okay, and you mentioned some family trauma or something like that. Is that something that you're free to talk about, or would you rather not?
Oh, yeah, certainly. My mom had cancer, had a very, very rare form of lung cancer. So she was given 3 months to live when I was about 10 years old, and she ended up living for 3 years. And so that was a very significant part of my life.
Sure.
In terms of trauma, and, you know, and there were some other pieces as well. And I also think just kind of how I was, as a person from a very early age, was pretty primed to be, focused on both how trauma plays out and also how it's set in a larger context of oppression and injustice. And so is, I think, that combination of what I came into the world with and then what transpired during some of my early years.
Now, you mentioned your undergraduate study at UC Santa Barbara. Did you do any graduate study later that, you know, to help you in your work with trauma?
Yeah, I did. I had the privilege of, when I was in Santa Barbara, I got to work with so many incredible mentors and just tremendous teachers in a number of different fields. And that was a huge gift. And that was, you know, 18, 19, 20, those years. And worked with some incredible colleagues. And, you know, at that age, many people at that age have quite a bit of stamina and can really go very hard. So we found ourselves working, you know, 60, 80-hour weeks in all of these very, very powerful fields. And it didn't take me long to realize that while I had a lot of commitment and a huge amount of passion, and I was very, very, you know, dedicated to this work, I was able to realize that I was lacking some theory, I was lacking some knowledge that would be very, very helpful. And, you know, you gain a huge amount by working 80-hour weeks, and also sometimes kind of pulling the lens back and getting a larger context for it, and is so important. And so I did decide to apply to grad school, and ultimately went to University of Washington in Seattle.
And what degree did you work on?
Social work. So it was a social work degree. And at the time at the school, they don't have it any longer, I don't think, but at the time at the school, they had concentrations, and I was in a multi-ethnic practice concentration.
Okay. And according to your bio on your website, I saw that you wrote that you nearly went psychotic as a result of all the traumatic stress that you were dealing with at the time. What can you tell us about that experience?
Yes. Well, so what happened for me was I had this privilege of getting to do such tremendous work, both in the areas of social justice and environmental justice and social change work and community organizing, and then very specifically with women in the sex trade and domestic violence and sexual assault and homelessness and child abuse and natural disasters. And so I was getting to do all these different levels of work, and I lacked any awareness of how much it was impacting me. And I had been doing the work, I'm sure people tried to indicate to me that I was struggling before this, but I remember about 10 years into my doing the work, that a number of people, at least a critical mass of people, started really trying to reflect back to me that, hey, Laura, you're tripping. You should take a break. And, you know, something that I continue to just marvel at was that a number of those folks were clients I was serving. So that's always disconcerting when, you know, you're working with clients and you're working with residents in a domestic violence shelter who can't go anywhere, who are just saying, like, how about you take the day off? But at the time, I was so, you know, it was the work has been such a part of me, and I was very cocky, and I was hugely arrogant, and I was incredibly self-righteous. And I really, you know, I was doing God's work, and I really felt like you could step up and help, or you could step off. But I had no interest in having a conversation with anybody about how I was impacted by my work. And remember, I'm sure, you know, this is nothing new to you, that you know, in many of these fields, there has been historically a sense that if you are tough enough, and if you are committed enough, and if you're cool enough, and if you're down with the cause enough, you're going to suck it up. So I was not in any field that had a supportive backdrop of cultivating awareness of how you're impacted by your work. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't interested in engaging in that conversation, and I had a lot of support from the fields I was in that one doesn't really engage, you know, take a hike if you need to, you know, go sit in a bath. But there weren't any, to me, that I had access to meaningful conversations happening where I was at the time of let's look at how exposure to trauma and suffering impacts folks individually and collectively. So, you know, finally got to a point where enough people were saying something to me, and particularly when clients started saying something to me, that it was able to interrupt some of my, you know, arrogance. So we took a short trip and we went to visit our family who lived in the Caribbean at the time. And, you know, this moment happened on a particular day where we went on this long hike as a family. And at the end of the hike, we were kind of on the top of these cliffs. So we're on this tiny Caribbean island, you know, standing on the top of these cliffs, and the family's gathered around and we're looking out, having a moment. And I remember that the first thing I thought was how gorgeous it was. And then the second thing that immediately rushed into my mind was, I wonder how many people have killed themselves by jumping off of these cliffs. Mm. And I said that out loud. You know, I worked at Harborview Hospital, which for folks in the Northwest, it's the level one trauma center for the entire Northwest. So that's where I worked, in the ER there. And so you just kind of start triaging. You know, you think where the helicopter would land, and you think how long it would take to, where is the nearest level one trauma center in the Caribbean, and you stop in customs on the way. Like, you just start going through the whole, you just go through this whole triaging. So I said that out loud because I was just thinking, everybody was thinking that, and I was just, you know, I was just starting a conversation that inevitably would happen. But in my family, nobody was thinking that in that moment. So it got even quieter than it has been, and my stepfather-in-law finally broke the silence and said, are you sure all this trauma work hasn't gotten to you? And it was really in that, that was the first moment I was able to have any honest awareness of, oh, check it out. There are people who can actually stand on top of a cliff and not wonder where the nearest level one trauma center is. But it wasn't me, and it wasn't anybody I was hanging out with, because the other thing I'm sure you know is, you know, when we do this work, we can get really isolated. And not that you're alone, but everybody I hung out with on top of, if they were on top of that cliff with me, also would have been wondering how many people had killed themselves. So that was when I realized kind of how close I was to having what I call was a near psychotic break of just, I was really at my brink.
What did you do to take care of yourself to come back off of that brink?
I recognized that I needed a lot of help, and I decided that I was not willing to push it any further with myself. And I think I was scared enough. I mean, I think it, you know, I was startled enough that I decided to find some teachers, and I started trying to think about who I felt that I could learn from. And I finally had enough awareness about how cocky I was and how, you know, I was very much in a state of folks don't understand, you know, how we get into that place if you don't get it, you know, if you don't do this work, and if you haven't been in the war, and if you haven't been in that forensic interview, and if you haven't testified in court, and if you haven't seen, you know, the starving animals or animals that are going extinct, you don't get it, you know. And I was very much in that state of like, so many folks don't get it. And so I had that awareness, and so I knew I needed to find some teachers who I wasn't going to be able to challenge, you know, who I would never take on. So I started following around people and asking to be people's students and sitting at the feet of as many people as I could. And, you know, that ranged everyone from Desmond Tutu to Thich Nhat Hanh to local teachers and folks from a number of different spiritual traditions. And I just started doing my own work on a whole different level.
So it was really a spiritual quest / cure that you embarked upon.
I mean, the theme with all the folks with whom I studied is definitely there is a strong spiritual component to them. I think the other theme was that I sought out people who had walked through the fire. I mean, I definitely sought out people, you know, I would never go up against Desmond Tutu, that he can't relate to what I've experienced. I would never take on Thich Nhat Hanh. I would never take on the incredible folks I've worked with in Utah. You know, I found people who I believed had walked through the fire to such a degree that I wasn't going to be able to sabotage my experience with them by discounting what they'd been through.
Yeah.
And it turned out that all of those folks had found a path. I mean, multifold path. You know, I mean, there's a huge amount of kind of intellect and philosophy and all of those pieces. And each of them definitely shared some sort of a spiritual component to it. Though each of them had a wide ranging, there was not one spiritual component. There was a number of them.
Yeah. Now, eventually you founded something that you call the Trauma Stewardship Institute. What do you mean by trauma stewardship?
So that came from a teaching by Jack Kornfeld, who I also have had the privilege of studying with, and there, I was listening to a Dharma talk that he was giving, and it was one of those moments where everything came together in terms of what I was believing that I needed and a way I wanted to interact with suffering in the world was how to care for it, how to be a steward of it. And I think for so long I had railed against oppression, and I'd railed against injustice, and I'd railed, you know, this idea that all these waves of suffering and hardship and tragedy and all these waves are going to continue to crash down on us. And while I deeply believe and am entirely committed to interrupting social injustice and environmental injustice and working for social change on every level I can, whenever I can, there was something that I was doing in terms of not accepting, not kind of waking up to the reality of what was happening. And there was so much railing against it, which, you know, entailed a lot of anger and a lot of cynicism and a lot of rage. And there was a direction I had been going with it that was not of benefit to me and was not of benefit to the folks I was trying to serve. So I then kind of shifted my path to simultaneously being able to work to interrupt those forces and work against those in all the ways I can, while also understanding that suffering has existed for so long and suffering will continue to exist. And I think there is a level of caring and tending to that needs to happen while it's unfolding. And so that's some of how I came to calling it trauma stewardship.
You were just talking about trauma stewardship, and mm-hmm. I gather there's a concept out there known as secondary trauma, and mm-hmm. I think that kind of relates maybe to this idea of trauma stewardship. So what can you tell us about that, about secondary trauma and how that relates to your mission?
Yes, well, so there's a number of people who have been my teachers and mentors and folks from who I have come after, who kind of I think founded or first started talking about these concepts, at least in this way of secondary trauma or compassion fatigue. A lot of people think about it in terms of burnout or mm-hmm. vicarious post-traumatic stress disorder.
Okay,
so that's the whole conversation of looking at how over time are folks affected, how does exposure to hard things, fundamentally shift one's worldview. And the way I think about it and talk about it is in terms of, for anyone who is out there in any way trying to help repair the world, right? And trying to help make the world a better place. And as a result of the work one's doing, whether paid or unpaid, volunteer, career, not career-wise, or the life you're living. So, if one is at home caring for one's mother who has early onset Alzheimer's, if you are at home caring for your son who is returning from Afghanistan, if you're home with a child with Asperger's, if you are that person everybody in the community comes to for everything. So there's all of those levels of it. And then there's folks who intentionally and willingly either seek a career or to spend a significant amount of time out in the community, in society, doing things where one knows you are going to be exposed to very, very, very hard things, either of humans, other living beings, or ecologically, the planet itself. We look at what is that toll over time. And part of what is interesting too about the conversation is some folks, you know, if you go into sexual assault work, you have some sense of how challenging and overwhelming that might be. A lot of the folks I'm working with are folks who went into a field, journalism, becoming a surgeon, you know, where they knew it was going to be hard. And also a lot of the folks I'm working with are folks, you know, librarians who go into the field of library science for very specific reasons. And then because of what is happening throughout our society and what burden many organizations are experiencing with the lack of resources and community centers shutting down, you know, we're seeing a huge number of librarians seek our support because they went into their field to be librarians. And now at their library, they are dealing with so many people who are struggling and really, really suffering and facing really hard situations. And they're librarians. And that's not what they're equipped to do. So it's been really, really interesting that there's folks who are seeking support from like, hey, I knew this was going to be hard to be an ecologist. You know, I never knew maybe it was going to be this hard. And then there's folks who are like, I didn't sign up for, you know, when I chose this field, I had no idea this was going to be the work I was doing.
Yeah, well, based on what you're saying right now, it's clear that you've worked with a very wide variety of populations on issues relating to trauma, exposure of various kinds. I'm wondering if there are a story or two that you could tell us. What are the most unusual of these, and are there any interesting anecdotes or stories from this work that come to mind?
I'm trying to think how I would do that. I think what I'm so struck by is the stamina that folks have and the capacity that folks have to endure caring for others. So I think what struck me so much is that whether or not I am working with, you know, an ecologist who is desperately trying to keep a species from going extinct, or I'm working with a school teacher in a public school in a large urban area, the way that they are grappling with what they're being exposed to is so similar. And one of the things that has been so moving to me is the degree to which folks will stay in there to be of service and the degree to which folks will remain committed to trying to help, whether it's their, you know, aunt who's living with them or it's countless families who come to their community organization, and how similar a phenomena it is, even if the fields are very, very diverse. So when we do these institutes now, you know, we have elected officials sitting next to folks who are at home caring for their child with autism, sitting next to journalists who are sitting next to school teachers, who are sitting next to librarians, who are sitting next to biologists. And while all the examples I would use would be different for, you know, what they might be able to relate to, they have a shared experience of this trauma exposure response. They have a shared experience of what this toll is on them. And I think I've been so struck by that and then just really, really touched by the lengths that folks will go to be able to figure out how they can keep doing this work or caring for others in their home or their community, even as the waves get bigger and bigger in our society.
Well, you talk about these institutes that you do. They sound like, are these workshops then, sort of traveling workshops that you do?
Yeah, so they're day long. Yes.
Okay. And and you've done them, all over the country or different countries?
Yes, uh-huh. A number of different cities, yes.
Yeah. And you've also written a book called Trauma Stewardship, An Everyday Guide to Caring for Self While Caring for Others. Maybe this is too obvious, but I wanted to ask you what led you to write the book.
Oh, yeah. I don't know that it is obvious. I was blessed to be able to lead a project in our county where years ago we were looking at why Child Protective Services, so the state, you know, Department of Social and Health Services, Child Protective Services, and folks in the domestic violence field were not collaborating, getting along as well as they could. We're not as cohesive of a group working together as they could be, because there are many, many reasons why Child Protective Services and Domestic Violence Service, there's a lot of benefit of them working well together. And at the time, things were strained and there were a number of challenges. So we were looking at why that was happening. And one of the factors that kept coming up with all the people I interviewed was this idea of secondary trauma. And that was during the time that we had talked about earlier, where I was gaining some increased awareness of kind of how, at my brink I was. And so I started then just kind of really ad hoc pulling together some training materials on how to start talking with people in a very accessible way, or the best of my ability I could, in an accessible way, on this idea of cumulative toll and some of the effects, because I was seeing it have such real and concrete effects on why these child protective service workers, who were incredible, and these domestic violence workers, who were incredible, were not collaborating to the best of their ability, and really looking at what was causing that society-wise, system-wise, movement-wise, agency-wise, and kind of internal shifts. So then I started just doing these trainings, and, one training led to a different training, which led to another training, which led to another training, and just through word of mouth, I then started being invited to do trainings beyond those fields. And so that then started happening, and, a number of years passed, and I was asked for a long time during that time to write a book on what I was teaching on, and kind of just this conversation. And I stubbornly refused, because I am... When I say I'm not a writer, that is a huge, I am so not a writer. So I just told everyone no, that there's no way I was going to write a book. And then after New Orleans, I went there and was able to do some volunteering there and spent some time there. And when I was leaving New Orleans, the folks who I had worked with, particularly at this one clinic, had asked me if I had anything in writing that I could leave with them. And I didn't have anything. I had nothing written down, and I felt horrendous. And I came home and huge amount of collaboration, wrote Trauma Stewardship. And I had a co-author, and I had two editors who were beyond brilliant, and it was a very collaborative effort.
Yeah.
And so that was very much in response to a request to do so, and with a significant amount of help.
You're a writer by demand. In the book, you talk about three levels of stewardship. What are those three levels?
Well, what we really tried to do in the book was set it in a large, have this whole conversation in a larger context of systematic oppression, and making sure that we were very, while we knew we couldn't do full justice to the conversation of systematic oppression in the book, nor when I, speak with folks or do work with folks, making sure we really had it set in a larger context of systematic oppression. So, folks know this, but reminding folks that the degree to which you're impacted by the work you're doing or the way you're living your life, it's intimately tied to a fact that we are in a society with so much supremacy and racism and sexism, homophobia, heterosexism, ageism, ableism, classism, xenophobia, all of this oppression. And if we're in a society where there wasn't that oppression, so much of the work that people are doing, then the folks with whom I get to work, a lot of that work would not exist. Some of it would. There would still be schools, and babies would still be born, and folks would die. And some of the work would exist, but so many of these fields are in response to manifestations of systematic oppression. So we really wanted to make sure that when we have a conversation about how an individual is affected by exposure to trauma, that is held in a larger context of systematic oppression, as well as how an organization, institution, agency, movement, field, that how the collective body is affected by exposure to suffering over time, that has to be within a larger context of systematic oppression as well. And frequently, that's not how it's talked about. So we wanted to make sure we were talking about it in that way. And then we also wanted to be able to honor the effect that this has on society as a whole, exposure to trauma. Also looking at collective bodies, so looking at whole agencies, become saturated. Entire institutions, you know, you can feel it. You walk in some of these places, and it's not a correlation between how hard the work is or how sad the work is or how intense the work is, because you can walk in some agency where there's intense work being done, and it feels really beautiful to be there. And then other organizations you walk into, and it is a palpable, just saturated, stagnant suffering. And so we really wanted to also really be able to talk about how an organizational, institutional agency culture is affected. And in fact, countless people say to me, look, I can handle the work I'm doing with the folks I serve, but what really brings me down is my colleagues. And that's, yeah. People talk about that across the board. Yeah. So we really wanted to make sure we were looking at it in terms of on that level as well. And then, of course, there's the individual level.
You talk about the 16 warning signs of trauma mm-hmm. exposure response. That's an interesting phrase, trauma exposure response, as if there is a phenomenon that you're observing mm-hmm. called the trauma mm-hmm. exposure response. So you might mm-hmm. say something about what that is and maybe what some of the key warning signs are. I don't expect you to rattle off all 16, but what are some?
Oh, sure,
of
sure. Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what's been so interesting, again, like we were saying earlier, is that, you know, whether or not you're working with somebody who works in prisons or you're working with somebody who runs a daycare, that they can really, that they can manifest the exact same signs. And of course, why that's happening is different because they're working with different populations. But what happens internally and what can happen throughout an agency, whether or not it's a preschool or a daycare or whether or not it's jail or prison, it can be a very, very similar experience. So some of the ones that folks really relate to is a sense of feeling hopeless, a sense of feeling helpless. So mm-hmm. that's the feeling like it's hard to get out of bed in the morning, right? Mm-hmm. That it just feels like, are we making any difference? Connected yeah. with that, you can feel like you're not doing enough. So folks can feel like it's not now and then you don't feel like you did enough, but you chronically feel like you're not doing enough and you constantly feel like you should be doing more.
Yes.
Numbing out is one that a lot of folks can relate to, that, you know, when I work with folks, I say, I'm not even going to ask if you numb out. Let's just go to the conversation of how frequently are you numbing out? You know, so just kind of across the board, the degree to which people are numbing out. Exhaustion, which gets written off a lot. I mean, I think a lot of folks think it is a direct causation that you do hard work and you're going to be exhausted all the time, which is not the case. But so exhaustion, I mean, profound, you know, like in your bone marrow exhaustion. There's anger, there's rage. Cynicism is a significant one, and most folks aren't grappling with straight up cynicism. It's much more the cynical humor. Mm-hmm. So that gets confusing for a lot of people too, because they're like, no, we're not angry. You know, we're funny. We laugh a lot. We have a great sense of humor. And then if you kind of track it, it's, you know, 100% cynical humor, which is not just pure hilarity. You know, there's something else going on there. Guilt happens a lot for folks. We see people struggle, of course, with addictions of all kinds. I mean, addictions to answering email, to addictions to pharmaceuticals, to caffeine, sugar, nicotine, adrenaline. So those are some of them.
Well, in a sense, you're talking about our whole society, it seems to me, mm-hmm. because there's a way in which I think we're all traumatized mm-hmm. In having this traumatic exposure response. I'm thinking of climate warming. I'm thinking of the loss of species that you've referred to, species extinction. I'm thinking of, you know, hearing that North Korea may attack us with an atomic bomb. I'm thinking of the constant oil wars that are going on. And, you know, this is something that all of us are dealing with. And I think in some ways, I'm aware in myself of, you know, creeping cynicism, numbing humor, all of that.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. And what somebody, you know, somebody who was very wonderful, she ran an independent bookstore in New York City, around the time that the first edition of the book came out. And she said, I need to tell you, you know, I'm carrying this book because folks have asked me to get it in the bookstore. But she said, as an owner of an independent bookstore in New York City, she's like, mm-hmm. I have every one of these signs of the trauma exposure response.
Yeah.
And that's what a number of people said to me, of just like, God, I mean, if one is kind of awake and conscious, most folks can relate to at least a number of things on there for sure.
Yeah. So what are, What are some of the prophylactic mental health or spiritual practices, mm-hmm. psychological practices that you recommend for trauma workers or for us generally to protect ourselves to, you know, the challenge? And I can see why you visited Desmond Tutu and Thich Nhat Hanh. The challenge is to somehow not withdraw and retreat, but to be able to take care of yourself and stay engaged somehow.
Right. Yeah. Yes. Yes. So a big piece of what we talk about is folks talking about it and folks interrupting their isolation. Because again, even though the culture has changed in a number of fields, and there are many more forms now to talk about how one is affected. And I think much of the attitude around that has shifted. You know, there's still in so many of these fields, there definitely remains that sense of if you're tough enough, you are going to suck it up. And self-care is for the weaker set, you know, and that remains. So for a number of people, a huge barrier is simply being able to identify, you know, we recently created a very short film that we put on our site, and Robert Rubkin was interviewed in it, and he's a physician's assistant. He was working out with Hurricane Sandy recently, and he said, you know, in that moment that you're able to identify that you're not as strong as you once thought you were, that is a pivotal moment to be able to interrupt one's own isolation and to be able to break that is huge. So whether or not you do that alone, that you just get honest with yourself of, wow, you know, what a child support enforcement worker once said to me, she said, I love my work and I hate the person I've become. So if you're able to identify with yourself, like, I have changed, you know, and it is not of benefit to me the way I've changed or to those I'm trying to serve, that is a huge first step. And then what we do is, you know, then there are so many ways to engage. I talk about it in terms of a daily practice, or a daily-ish practice, if a daily practice might put some people over the edge. But I talk about it in terms of, you know, in a 24-hour period, having a commitment, a discipline to do something or a number of things with an intention of being able to cultivate your capacity on some level to simply be present.
What sorts of practices?
Yeah. So in terms of efficiency and effectiveness, one of the most efficient and effective things folks can do if medically sound for them is to get their heart rate up, is to break a sweat, is to be able to physiologically release toxins, to re-regulate their brain chemistry, to be able to re-regulate their nervous system. And that, you know, of course, the core of that is breath work. And breath work, when you look at, you know, whether it's practices in India or practices in the Copper Canyon of Mexico, at least all of the ancient traditions I have studied, the core of all of them is engaging in intentional breath to be able to help sustain. So in our society, part of the way that looks is, you know, working out or dancing or contemplative prayer or chanting. There's a number of ways that one can do that. But, you know, you're doing it not at the gym in front of Fox News or MSNBC the whole time, right? You can't be like kind of there trying to purge while having six screens of mass destruction on in front of you. So there's an intention, you know, at some point during your day of like, I am going to, anything that is accumulated in me over the last 24 hours, you know, I've got to move that out of me. Because part of what we look at is just physiologically saturation and how we get saturated as a result of this exposure. So that is a big piece of what we talk about. Breaking isolation, another very significant step. Gratitude. And that can feel so contrived to people, and a lot of folks kind of just get their back up with that. But, you know, and so many people know that few things will sustain us in life as much as gratitude will. And so a lot of folks, morale is low in so many of the places I work. And so part of the practice of gratitude is being able to shift it from, you know, the big multi-million federal grant that nobody's getting right now, you know, being able to shift it away from that to noticing anything that is going well. right? And being able to, there was an incredible judge who I got to work with recently in New York, who said at the end of his day, he forces himself to sit in his judge's chambers and before he leaves, kind of roll through everything that happened that day and find anything that he was able to do that transpired in that day that helped somebody.
Mm-hmm.
And he was saying,
yeah,
if you don't, you know, if one doesn't do that very deliberately, it takes no time for many of us before all we see is all the ways we failed. And all we see is all the families we couldn't help and all the animals we couldn't help and how wrecked things are. And so with that gratitude practice, it's a very deliberate, proactive, you know, what I talk with people about is for every electronic device you have, set alarms to go off multiple times a day. It takes, you know, 0.01 second, and those are your gratitude alarms. And when they go off, you just, you know, in neuroscience, they say whatever fires together, wires together, right? So you're just trying to, as those alarm goes off, you just say to yourself one thing that you're grateful for. And a lot of times people, you know, you have to dig pretty deep because a lot of times we're not feeling gushing in gratitude. And particularly I talk with people doing this a lot in their workplaces where even less sometimes, you know, folks are like, my staff meeting, like we never talk about what we're grateful for. So gratitude practice is another one we talk about. So there's a number of practices, but much of what we talk about is folks gaining some awareness of their level of capacity and their level of overwhelm. And making sure that they are bringing in practices that increase their capacity to be present and really help them gauge whether or not they're overwhelmed. Because, you know, when humans are in an overwhelmed state, that is not sustainable.
What's your hope for the future of this work? Where do you see your institute going in the future?
Oh, that's a nice question. I mean, my hope is that if there is anything I am able to do that is of benefit for folks, I would love to be able to continue to do that. And so for right now, what it seems is that there remain, you know, countless folks nationally and internationally who are extremely isolated and for whom even engaging in a conversation of how they're impacted is really significant. And so however long I'm able to do this for in terms of continuing that conversation and increasing awareness and breaking isolation and simultaneously working for larger shifts in terms of social justice and environmental justice, because we're definitely needing to tend to what is causing so much of the suffering, and we are needing to continuously interrupt that and work to dismantle that. So for as long as I'm able to do this, that's very meaningful to me to be able to do it. And what I'm also noticing is as we're able to engage in this conversation on a larger scale and get a critical mass of folks having these conversations, then we're able to continue to take the conversation deeper and deeper and deeper. And deeper, primarily in terms of both the systematic oppression components and also in terms of the neurophysiology of it, and also in terms of the intergenerational trauma of it, and also in terms of, you know, what's our plan as far as how we are going to sustain? Because at least everybody I'm called to work with, they're all being asked to do more and more with fewer and fewer resources. So then we're trying to have deeper conversations around how are we going to sustain? And that, you know, in the home, how do you sustain taking care of a family member who's really facing a lot of health, you know, complications for years in your home? And how do you sustain heading up a whole organization or movement with what's going on?
Mm-hmm. Well, as we wind down, I wonder if there's anything more that you'd like to leave our listeners with, if there are any last thought or challenge that you'd like to put out there.
I think I just so much would urge folks that, you know, if they see in themselves any impact of how, you know, their lives or their work might be affecting them and affecting them in a way that feels like a lot of what we talk about is this whole ethic of doing no harm. So if folks in any way feel that harm is being done to them, that, that there is an impact that is happening individually for them or, you know, in their collective body, which is their family or their community or where they're working, that they would seek support for themselves. And, you know, they say there's a thousand doors to enlightenment. So there's no limit on how one can get support for oneself. And that they, you know, a very significant first step is making sure to interrupt the isolation around it. And then I think knowing that a number of these practices, they don't take for people who are maxed out and would say, you know, I don't have any time in my day to do anything else, that there's a lot of ways that we're able to engage with folks creatively. So many of these practices can be when you're up against the wall and you have no time left. Folks can still engage in a number of practices that can be meaningful and that can really help make sure that harm is not being done to the best of our ability and actually engage folks in a way that they can, you know, they can metabolize what they're bearing witness to and what they're experiencing in a way that they can actually transform this trauma.
Well, that's a great charge that you're leaving us with. So, Laura Vandernoot Lipsky, it's been great to speak with you and to hear about your work. And I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so, so much for having me.
What a powerhouse Laura is. She projects such dynamism and energy. It's easy to see how she burnt out early on. What impressive mentors she sought out for her healing. Desmond Tutu, Thich Nhat Hanh, and Jack Kornfield were the names I recognized. As she indicated, each of them are spiritual warriors who have engaged with real-world social activism. As you heard me comment, I think we're all staggering and probably somewhat in denial in the face of all the problems facing our planet today. I'm thinking of fundamentalist fanaticism, climate change, loss of rainforests, seemingly endless oil wars, nuclear threats, environmental degradation, loss of species, the shrinking polar caps, the widening gulf between the haves and the have-nots, and on and on. So in this sense, I think we're all traumatized and either are in shock and denial or perhaps in grief. The challenge for each of us is to maintain some sense of balance, remember all that we do have to be grateful for, and to stay engaged in whatever ways we can. I would suggest a particularly relevant companion piece for this interview is number 279, Grief, Ritual, and the Soul of the World, with Frances Weller, M.A. Frances was especially soulful and articulate on these themes, and I heard from many of you who were especially touched by that interview. The title of Laura's book, once again, is Trauma Stewardship, An Everyday Guide to Caring for Self While Caring for Others. And, of course, you can order it using the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our site.
Hi, Dave. My name is Dr. Michael O'Canna, and I'm a medical director for an adolescent psychiatric unit up here in British Columbia. I've been listening to your podcast for about a week now, and in summary, I'm thrilled. You've collected interviews with some of the most exciting thinkers in neuroscience and mental health treatment today. I agree with the recent direction of your thinking. The age of Pax Medica is coming to a close, and a much more exciting era seems to be on the horizon. So, I have decided to show my support, and I encourage all of your listeners to do the same. Just hit that support button and show Dave that you care. It feels good. Thanks, Dave, and I look forward to keeping up with your podcast.
Thank you for that ringing endorsement, Dr. Michael O'Canna. By the way, let me recommend Dr. O'Canna's blog to you. You'll find it at teenshrinktalk.blogspot.ca. So this would be particularly relevant if you've got some teens, and you might even get them to check it out. If you're listening to Shrink Wrap Radio but have not clicked on the subscribe button on whatever software you're using, please do so. Or just find us on iTunes and click on the subscribe button there. According to FeedBurner, I have about 3,600 subscribers. which I feel very happy for. However, for the Judith Rustin interview, for example, it looks like more than 18,000 of you downloaded that one. So you can see there's a big gap between those two numbers. I have a lot of listeners who are not subscribers, so please become a subscriber. It helps me to know how many of you are out there, and I'm pretty sure it helps us to rank among the top podcasts on iTunes. I've been seeing the Shrink Wrap Radio logo on both the iTunes listings for new and noteworthy on both the education and the separate higher education podcast pages. In fact, last week at one point, we were ranked as number 3 in the top podcasts in higher education. Let's push ahead for number 1. I'm happy to report that we do seem to have experienced some growth over the past couple of years, and you can help keep us on that trend by letting all your psychologically interested friends know about all the wonderful content waiting here for them. It's not always easy to persuade people, I know. There are a lot of people out there who still haven't figured out what a podcast is or how to get it. And I'm constantly handing out cards to new people I meet, but I'm not sure they always follow up. But let's keep giving it the old college try. When you go on our site, you'll see a number of past interviewees who are advertising their books in the right-hand sidebar. Now, they've made a small donation to Shrink Wrap Radio for that opportunity, so I hope you'll reward them for doing so, you know, by buying their books.
Shrink Wrap Radio, the podcast that's always on your mind, here on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Oscar, my good friend in Stockholm. Oscar will not be my next guest. I'll tell you who will be in a bit, though. Now let's listen to a few recent emails from our listener community. First, we hear from Gary Eisenberg, who has been helping me with audio editing on some of these interviews recently. Gary begins by reacting to my interview with on number 342 with Jungian analyst Michael Conforti. And he writes, "Dear David, first of all, your questions and comments were right on the money, perfectly timed and paced to bring out the best of this brilliant man, whom I had never heard of before this morning when I listened to number 342. This, David, is another reason why I knew I needed to reach out and offer some sort of support to you, and why you can count on my continued audio editing skills, regardless of how busy things get for me." Thank you very much for that, Gary. He goes on to say, "Secondly, I was really impressed with Dr. Conforti's observations. I'm going to be looking into his work, to be sure, starting with right after I finish this email to you. His observations about archetypal patterns, as well as the significance of dream content, have really prompted me to think about the content of my own dreams, as well as how I might be more observant of patterns as they relate to my day-to-day perspective on life. I was particularly struck by the segment on the retired professor's dream about discovered underground wood. The way Conforti connected the potential value of that wood, explaining that there was a downside to the dream in that we could be dealing with lost potential, and then tying it all together by urging the professor to return to some form of teaching. Brilliant. The quality of the wood in and of itself was of interest to me as a woodturner, one of my many hats that I might not yet have shared with you, because I have discovered some exquisite blocks of wood that only revealed their beauty after being turned. Sometimes we can be or become oblivious to the value of things because they aren't, quote, shiny enough or may have seemed to lose their luster over years of familiarity. At the ready for the next audio that requires editing, I'm enthusiastically yours, Gary Eisenberg." Well, Gary, I am enthusiastically yours in return, and will be sending you many a audio in the coming years, and I really appreciate the comments that you shared here. And also, I appreciated the reference to your website where you showed a lot of your art. You are truly a multi-talented fellow. I think if you Google Gary Eisenberg, you will find his website. Next, we hear from Andy, who is both a listener and also author of a new book, Tarot and the Expressive Arts. Andy writes, "Hi, David. Thank you for your reply." He had actually suggested that he would be interested in perhaps being interviewed about his new book, and I suggested and I replied that I could not necessarily guarantee an interview, but if he wanted to send me a copy of the book, I would consider it. And he replies, "Thank you for your reply, and I understand about not being able to commit to an interview. Actually, I just thought this might be something you'd enjoy reading. I do wish I could be at your talk at the Reader's Studio this year. I think it is high time that more people consider the application of tarot within the psychotherapeutic context. By the way, besides being a therapist, I also teach abnormal psych at our local community college and always share your website with my classes. The students love it because it exposes them to so much that is interesting about our field. Thank you for providing such a great resource. Best wishes, Andy." Well, Andy, I especially appreciate your sharing it with your students. I'm always really happy because I think I have almost accidentally created an incredible teaching resource here that I wish a lot more professors, instructors, and so on would take advantage of. So I really appreciate that. And I'm looking forward to seeing your book. And, of course, you were referring to this keynote that I'm going to be giving at the conference that's put on by the Amberstones in a that I covered in a recent Shrink Wrap Radio here. Finally, we hear from Alexandra, who responded to my thanks for her donation. "This is the second year," she writes, "this is the second year I'm taking the monthly donation. Before only did it one time, but now I guess she's doing it monthly." And she goes on to say, "I certainly will gather a lovely vocal testimony on your recorder soon." Well, I hope so, because I've suggested that to a number of donors, and I've kind of run out. She goes on to say, "Thank you for all the wonderful years of competent guests and available material. Bravo to you, bringing your vision to life, and of course, all the hard and great work you've done and continue to accomplish." And that's from Alexandra in Montreal. So, Alexandra, thanks so much for this note and for your donation and for what I hope will be the verbal recording that you'll send my way. So with that, we'll wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Remember that in addition to your emails, you can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone at 206-350-9918. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Laura Vandernoot-Lipsky for sharing her work in trauma stewardship. My next guest will be Aikido Sensei Nick Walker, whom I interviewed previously on Shrink Wrap Radio number 323, Aikido Empathy and Neurodiversity. This time we will focus more specifically on his neurodiversity advocacy work as an autistic man himself. I think you'll find it very mind-opening. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.